Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a fascinating show for you this evening. Tracy Curtis Taylor is here, and she's going to tell us the story of three epic flights across the world's continents, tracing the paths of history's trailblazing female pilots. I met Tracy at the Legends of Aviation event, and I can tell you she is an absolutely amazing individual. Cannot wait for you to meet her and hear her story and learn so much about this amazing, amazing aviatrix. Before we get started, just a few things. Flying and flying events are absolutely booming inside socialflight.com. So be sure to check out socialflight.com and the free Social Flight mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. We have tens of thousands of aviation events and destinations, our FAA learning system where you can take wings or AMT, IA courses, learn about your aircraft, learn about flying. We just uploaded a bunch of new courses just today from the FAA and from many others out there. There's even a course there for AOPA's General Aviation Pause Program. Be sure to check that out. There's one that just went up on what to do with propeller strikes. If that happens, I mean, there's a ton of knowledge. It's all out. It's all free, directly within Social Flight. And we have our Fly to Win challenge. We just gave away another Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. And now we've got another prize period that just started on August 1st. We are going to be giving away an Aspen E5 electronic flight instrument glass for your panel. And you can win that simply by getting the free Social Flight mobile app. Just check in at any airport, even one time, and you're entered in to win. And if you do it multiple times and get on our leaderboard, you get extra entries. I love giving stuff away, and it's all made possible by the folks here over my shoulder on that board that makes Social Flight possible. Now, tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Whip Air and their amazing Whipline line of floats. Their factory in South St. Paul is absolutely spectacular. If you ever get there, we have gone there and made a video and checked it all out. It is, you can really see an amazing facility by Whip Air, and they are so much more than floats. They've got avionics, paint, interior, maintenance, you name it. If you want to learn about it, go check them out and be sure to tell them that we sent you from Social Flight. Now on to tonight's guest. Born in England, but raised in Canada, Tracy Curtis Taylor had her first flying lesson at age 16. Her fascination with vintage aircraft led her to early biplanes and World War II training aircraft, including the North American T-6 Harvard, or Texan for those of us in the United States, and her trusty 1942 Boeing Stearman. In 2013, she followed Mary Heath's historic 1928 solo flight from Cape Town to London, followed in 2015 with an epic flight following Amy Johnson's 1930 flight from England to Australia. Not wanting to leave out good old North America, Tracy capped off her trilogy of adventures by flying the United States Transcontinental Mail Route in tribute to Amelia Earhart, who was the first woman to fly across America. Tracy's book, Bird, which we're going to talk about a bit tonight, it chronicles these epic adventures and her own personal story and struggles. It is a fascinating tale of the challenges of cross-continent flying and pushing through immeasurable logistical and aeronautical obstacles. It's a celebration of the historic achievements of the female pioneering aviators of the 1920s and 1930s. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Tracy Curtis Taylor. Hello, Tracy.
Hello,
how
Jeff.
Are you?
I'm very well, thank you. What a pleasure to be here on the show.
I am thrilled that you are taking time to join us tonight. I'm very, very excited about this. And again, you know, the book, I really do. I finished it only a couple days ago. We've spoken, I knew, of course, of your story, but getting to read it and get into detail about what it took and what drove you towards this was truly, truly fascinating. Tell me a little bit about your childhood and what kind of brought you towards aviation.
Well, I had no direct exposure to aviation, but I think our family were, perfectly ordinary in so many respects. But the one thing that I can identify is that there was a lot of mobility. I had traveled across the Atlantic twice by ocean liner before I was 10. So we emigrated to Canada in 1964 and then came back again in 1972. So our upbringing, predominantly in British Columbia, out in the mountains, it was a frontier upbringing. So it was rugged and lots of traveling and camping and traveling across Canada on trains. And, so I understood mobility and freedom. And I was raised with this kind of idea of call of the wild. And I think when I look back, funny enough, when I came to write the book, it's only when you really look back on, 60 years of your life that you start to get this perspective and you start to see the real themes. And in my case, they're very clear. My passion, I think, and compulsion to adventure and freedom and mobility, and the aviation became a natural progression. Although, can I say, there were still all the usual obstacles in the way. I couldn't join the Air Force because the British Air Force didn't take female pilots back in 1980 when I was looking at career options. I couldn't join the Air Cadets. That also wasn't available to females, so I couldn't. The boys in our class, where they're doing navigation O level and gliding and so forth, not open to females. I didn't go to university, so you couldn't join the university air squadron. There were no scholarships, so there was no career advice. There was nothing. By the time we came back to England, I was raised in a farming town, and we had a pizza restaurant. So, aviation wasn't obvious, I must say.
Yes, but at the same time, you say that you had this normal kind of upbringing, and yet you had clearly a drive to sort of raise yourself up by the stirrups. You tell story about wanting a horse, which and at a time that your family was living in an apartment, and how you made these things happen, kind of manifesting something like that, not through wishing, but through work. And that seems to have been the same type of theme that brought you through into aviation. This was by no means handed to you.
No, it wasn't. It was longing. I must admit, I think I must have always had great longings. And fairly early on, I had this idea that life should be about great kind of projects, But so for me, my obsession with the horse, I thought, after we'd been wrenched away from Canada, this amazing life that we had there, that was a really golden period for our family. And we all feel the same way. I have three siblings. But for me, the trade-off was if I could have the horse, that's the compromise. I can put up with England, I can put up with living in this confinement, but that's the condition, that's the contract. And my parents were adamantly against it. And I just worked obsessively for the next 2 years, and I finally bought my foal because I couldn't afford to buy, a mature horse, a riding horse. So I just struggled through all of that with him for several years, and the effort to just keep him. And he was always miles away, so I was always on bikes and hiking up the fells. He was farmed out to various friends, and just, the struggle to keep him. And of course, there was a tragic end to it. But funny enough, the same focus, you're absolutely right, that I brought to the horse, I brought to flying. So when I had my first taste of it at 16, I was still at home and working and doing my A levels, and then I went to London. But by the time I was 21 and in New Zealand with my twin sister, I thought, right, this is it. I'm going to learn to fly. So, but it just took time. And of course, paying for it was the biggest challenge. So I just kind of waitressed my way through it. Just, I was absolutely single-minded. It still took me a long time to do it, make no mistake about it. But, because at that point, I'm trying to establish myself in New Zealand. I'm fighting against the immigration. You have to not only do the thing, but you have to make a case to be there to do it. So there's always this kind of double challenge. But New Zealand was very, very significant to me, really, in those early years. I was there for 14 years. It was infinitely cheaper to learn to fly in New Zealand than it was in England. It was much more accessible. New Zealand is a bit like America. It's a great flying country, and a lot of people do it, and it's a lot cheaper. So I waitressed my way through a private, a commercial license. I did my instructor rating. But the real key to this was I was mad about old aeroplanes. I mean, I'd watched, I think when you say, what was the inspiration? All those years as a family, when I was only young, six, seven, eight, 10, watching those magnificent men in their flying machines, which for those aviation enthusiasts that have never seen this, this was a 1963 film in England, and it was about all the early, I mean, the really early years of aviation. So we've got the sort of character of Orville Wright, we've got Blériot, we have all the nations competing in a race across the English Channel. It's hilarious. But so it's old, you know, funny old flying machines, and I was just enthralled by it. It's still one of my favorite films, and I really honestly credit that with firing my interest in old stuff.
That's fascinating. And I have to say, you use the word longing, which I have not actually heard someone use that word towards their aviation passion before. And it is so beautifully appropriate in this case.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, so well, tell me a little bit more about New Zealand and that side of kind of getting involved in that aircraft and in those type of aircraft, and when you kind of started to find your legs in that.
Well, the reason I went to New Zealand, Jeff, was because my twin sister emigrated there in 1981 and got married very young. And I, at that point, went to Africa for a year in 1982. So I had this epic year in Africa. And at the end of that, in early 83, I went to join my twin sister. So it was really then. Are we okay technically?
Someone got in somehow using that login. Let me dismiss them.
Okay.
I don't know who that is. Did you send out your link to
someone? It's actually a friend of mine, Chris Bowl from Boeing.
Oh,
that. They're not allowed to join by that link. Oh.
No, they're using your link. So.
Oh, no.
Let's ask them to excuse. There we go. That worked.
So no, just to recap, I went to New Zealand in early 83 to join my twin sister. So it was really ground zero. It was right. And I lived down in the South Island in Queenstown. I thought, right, where do I start? And I literally just went down to the local aero club and went and mixed with the locals. And, you know, people would just take me flying, you know, and so I'd end up landing on beaches on the West Coast and, you know, picking up lobster and dropping off mail and nipping through the Southern Alps, the mountains. And they just suddenly flip, the, you know, say, have you ever been inverted? So flip the aeroplane upside down. So there were these just amazing experiences, or herding cattle and sheep from an aeroplane. You know, I mean, so the key is, the Kiwis just did a sort of flying that you just don't see in many.
Not even a helicopter, an aircraft, an actual airplane. That's amazing.
Yeah. But they developed, you know, all the deer recovery using helicopters, and I used to fly with some of those guys as well. So I had a really unusual flying, you know, these wonderful kind of experiences. But that's where I started, in Queenstown, doing my private license. But again, just the struggle to keep it all going. And then I moved to Auckland, and that's when I started in earnest. So I just, but again, I just waitressed. I was doing about three jobs to try and keep the flying going. I was doing a bit of modeling, I was waitressing, and I was stacking supermarket shelves, you know, with product to pay for it and to work around, you know, the training and the flying hours. So it was, and then I ended up joining the New Zealand Warbirds. And that was when I first, you know, when my first biplane was actually an SE-5A replica, which was a World War I British fighter credited with bringing down Richthofen, but of course that was just a, you know, a myth, I think. But yeah, but it was a replica, and that was the first one I flew. So it was just a 9/11 replica. But this, when I saw this aeroplane, and of course they're handmade aeroplanes, and I sort of gingerly looked into the cockpit and all the kind of rolled leather and stitching and all this. I mean, they're handmade aeroplanes, hand stitching on the wings, and everything's leather and very simple cockpit. And I just, you know, a joystick and so simple controls. And I just looked at that and I thought, oh God, if I could just fly that, that would be all I would ever need to achieve, if I could just do that one thing. And I eventually bought into the syndicate. So you could buy in very cheaply, because very few people flew these things, because it was a solo seat. You had to really just go out and learn to fly it yourself. So there was a few dodgy landings, and I go up and do a few tentative aerobatics, you know, a lot of very, you know, egg-shaped loops. But that was a great kind of threshold for me flying that aeroplane. I terrified myself in it, I might add, you know, flying cross countries over tiger country in it with there's no radio, there's no, you know, it's there's nothing in it. Lost a map out the side, the weather closed in. I'm thinking, oh, you know, this is it. But that's how the pioneers were. I mean, that's how it was.
That is amazing. And you know, I'm fascinated by New Zealand and its aviation community. It's funny, there's a connection there because you certainly see over my shoulder here the Mustang that we're building. And that, for this strange reason, there is a group of Titan aircraft builders all in New Zealand. The gearbox comes from New Zealand. This really, there's so much aviation there. And my eyes have become open to that. It really is quite a fascinating place.
The Kiwis are great at this stuff, believe me. And they, you know, they operated a team of the Auckland Warbirds where I joined, and I ended up again getting into a syndicate with a T6, and again they trained me to fly it. So although I could never join the military, I was trained by military pilots to fly these airplanes. So it was just remarkably fortunate for me, you know, and they were terrific. I mean, of course, there was a lot of banter, and there's, you know, most of the guys are military, not all of them, but it was a wonderful community, and I had 11 years of flying with them, you know, formation stuff, and we do these wonderful fly-ins all around the country, Warbirds over Wanaka. Sir Tim Wallace, very famous New Zealand aviator who had Spitfires, and he made a fortune in deer recovery with helicopters. And then became a great Warbird man, you know, and that's how I met some of the Warbird operators through him eventually when I moved back to England and actually here in California.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a very small community, the Warbird crowd, and very brilliant.
That is so amazing. Tell me a bit about your transition then and discovering sort of from a pilot's perspective, the steerman, because for people, I mean, many people are familiar with the term steerman, but until you've been up close to one of them compared to many of the other types of aircraft that you're talking about, you don't necessarily realize how big a steerman is. This is not a small aircraft. What was that transition like?
Well, Jeff, you know, can I just say there aren't too many small American aeroplanes. All American stuff, they are big, you know, quite masculine aeroplanes, but they've got big cockpits, you know, they've got, you know, roomy cockpits, they've got great kind of, there's certain generic about American aeroplanes, I think. So I can feel the similarity actually between, I used to have the Ryan PT-22, that was like a little T6. So I had the prototype of that aeroplane for 18 years, which I had in England at the Shuttleworth collection, but that was like a little T6. And if you can fly those, to get into a steerman is an easy transition. You know, once you can actually fly tail draggers, and they say if you can fly a T6, you can probably fly most things. Nobody's let me fly a Mustang yet, though.
Well, I think you'd be well equipped for it. And my guess is that with your connections, you may find that happening sooner rather than later. I've had it described to me that it's the steerman with that mass. It's all about that momentum, about keeping yourself on the right side of that. Is there any truth to that?
Well, it's just managing energy. And there's obviously a lot of, you know, there's a lot of wing area on it. You know, it's a big aeroplane with a lot of, so you can feel that. And you can certainly feel that in wind and turbulence. But on the other hand, it also makes it quite gentle, all this billowing around, because you're not traveling anywhere at any great speed. But I just love them. I think it's a terrific aeroplane. And you know, I was in love with the airplane for years and years. I didn't fly one until, I don't know, probably 15 years ago, maybe the first time I flew it, but they just looked fantastic. It looked like the proper job. You know, a big radial engine. You know, what you're looking at there is really 1930s technology with the wing struts and the you know, the crossed wires, the flying and landing wires. I don't have mine covered up. You know, some of the bigger engine models have the cowling around the engine, but I wanted mine to look, you know, kind of agricultural, really. You know, it was an expeditionary airplane. So, you know, and it was on dirt strips and landing on salt pans and so on. So, it's a rugged airplane, the Stearman. I mean, this was one of the, you know, the most, the, the greatest trainer, probably a basic trainer for World War II, for World War II pilots. Mine was actually a Navy trainer. And then, like so many of them, they were adapted after the war and used as crop dusters.
Yeah.
So, you know, barnstorming airplanes, you know, so they were modified almost beyond recognition. They'd have these big tanks, you know, chemical tanks, and the couple of instruments would actually be attached upon the top wing. I mean, phenomenal looking machines, and they'd have great big engines on them. And that's the beauty of the Sturm, and they'd put so many different, they'd configure so many different engines on it. So enormously versatile. So mine was then wrecked, I guess, back in the 1980s, somewhere out in Midwest. And then when I commissioned the restoration, I found a Stearman specialist in Europe, Rare Bird Aviation. And they just brought the wrecks from America, you know, by container. And then you could commission the restoration and have it customized to suit what you wanted. And that, you see, that's the beauty of American airplanes. So you can say, right, there's your standard fuselage. I want that engine. I don't want the double ailerons. This is a cruising airplane. So I just said, there's no flaps on it. It's just one big aileron on the bottom wing. I've got extra fuel tanks in the top wing. So I've got a 6-hour range up there. So 6 hours of endurance, but it's about 380 nautical miles range in no wind conditions. So it's been modified. There's a bigger baggage container in it for my Estee Lauder and my hairdryer and so forth. Traveling aviatrix, there's always a lot of extra kit. But it's a beautiful machine. And I wanted it to look, because it is quite a masculine looking aeroplane, I wanted it to look more period. I didn't want it to look military. And I wanted it to look more female, feminine, you know, because so I had it painted in this lovely kind of dark forest green with cream wings. And then I had the insignia on it, Boeing and Spirit of Artemis. Artemis was my principal sponsor. And the aeroplane just looked absolutely mouthwatering. You know, there's not many Stearmans that look like this, I can tell you. And now, of course, we brought it back to America for the third time, you know, which is a hell of a thing, just dismantling this, shoving it into a 40-foot container. And shipping it to America again, so it's a hat trick.
That is really, really amazing. Let's talk about your journeys, starting, of course, with the first that you did, the Cape Town trip. Tell me a little bit about what inspired, when you got the idea to recreate Lady Heath's journey, and I guess first tell people about what her journey was. And who she was.
Well, there's something that precedes that in a way. And it was the film, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with, the film Out of Africa. Mm. I, in my teens, was obsessed with Africa. I read about it. I when I joined the diplomatic service in London, I just wanted a posting to Africa. And when I eventually got to New Zealand and I was flying, you know, the film came out in 1985. And it's... One, her story for me has been one of the most powerful things in my life for many reasons. There's a lot of interesting convolutions with it, but there's the flight in the film, and it's really the consummation of the love story between Karen Blixen and Dennis Finch-Hatton. And he gets the aeroplane to show her farm in Africa. So it's that wonderful scene of the yellow tiger moth flying, tiptoeing over the Ngong Hills into the Rift Valley. And flying low over the plains, over the wildebeest, and then it's just the most romantic, magical thing I'd ever seen. And when I saw it, I thought, that's exactly how I want my life to be, you know? So that was actually the seed of the inspiration. So that goes back to 1985. So I didn't fly that until 27 years later. But funny enough, it crystallized in... I was being filmed out at the Shuttleworth Collection in Bedfordshire with my Ryan, the PT-22. And the girl said to me, she said, so what would you most like to do in your life? And I, without even hesitating, I said, you know what? I just like to fly up Africa in a biplane. You know, it's the Out of Africa flight. That's what I want to do. And even as I said it, something literally took flight. It was like I had this moment. I suppose you call it an epiphany, but I just had this euphoria. It was like the whole moment was supercharged with the certainty that I actually would do it. But can I say it took four years from that point to find the aeroplane, to build the sponsorship, to build the team behind it, to build the route, you know, and everything else. So it was a huge logistical exercise, and it took four years. to pull that together.
And that is really, is really amazing. Yes, and I know this is obviously the later version of the paint, but I know people want to see the plane as we do that. What I'd like to do, though, is bring up a map of what those adventures are so people can visualize a little bit. And you have this in the book, certainly, but it's I think, remarkable to actually sort of see how far that journey is. And it is anything but a straight line. For reasons you explain.
Well, funny enough, what you don't see from that map is, again, the whole curvature of the longitude from England to the Cape of Africa. That is 10,000 miles. And the flight from England to Australia, that was 14,500 miles. So there's, you know, obviously a bit longer going to Australia, which is halfway around the world. But the Africa flight was very special for me. It was because, one, it was about the Karen Blixen story, and it was only after that that I then heard about Lady Heath, because I thought, well, okay, I can fly up Africa, but really, this needs to be a journey back in time. And about the same time, I was given this book, and it was called Lady Icarus, and I had never heard about this particular female pilot, and her name was Mary Heath. Lady Heath, she married the title. He was 45 years older than she was, so it was clearly a career move. It was her second husband at this point. She would go on to marry three times, so she had a very interesting life, Mary Heath. But she was, and I would urge, again, people to read, this was a rather wonderful book by Lindy Norton called Lady Icarus. And I won't sidetrack into Mary Heath's story, but it's absolutely extraordinary. Suffice to say, she learned to fly in the mid-1920s. She'd worked as a dispatch rider on the front in World War I. She was one of our first female Olympic athletes, and she finds aviation. Very gifted woman. She was a journalist, but she's an athlete, so she was a real all-rounder. But she goes on to become the first woman to hold a commercial pilot's license in Britain, first woman to parachute out of an aeroplane. But her greatest claim to fame was this historic flight up Africa. She is the first person to fly solo from Cape Town back to England in 1928. So this is a year after Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. Lindbergh electrified the world with his feat, and aviation just suddenly became this worldwide craze. So Mary Heath kind of surfed in off the back of that and made her name doing this extraordinary flight. So I thought, wow, but she's almost completely forgotten today. So I thought, right, in doing the flight, and of course you can't create anything, recreate meaningfully what they did back in the 1920s and 30s, because what they did was just so exceptional and fantastic. So we were trying to follow the route as far as possible and to tell her story, because of course we had a film crew along, and we ended up making the documentary, which the BBC screened in 2005 many, many times to great reviews. And it was really putting Lady Heath, it was called The Aviatrix, The Lady Who Flew Africa. So that was our tribute to Mary Heath. And then after that, of course, in fact, it was the Boeing team who said, well, Trace, what are you going to do next? And I thought, well, you know, thinking I might fly to India. And they said, India, don't stop there. Why don't you fly on to Australia? So then it became obvious that it probably should be Amy Johnson's flight. And Amy Johnson was like the British Amelia Earhart. She was the first woman to fly solo from England to Australia. She was trying to break the world record, which stood at 15 days. And the amazing thing is, I mean, here is Amy. She's only just recently learned to fly. She's also qualified as an engineer. Again, a rather rocky, emotional kind of family life prior to that. And she finds aviation, which becomes her kind of salvation, really. But many, many felt it was a suicide flight, what she was attempting. This is a slip of a girl, 26 years old, who's got less than 100 hours in her logbook. She gets her flimsy little gypsy moth and she takes off from Croydon, and 19 days later she arrives in Darwin. So five people to see her off in Croydon, the whole world following her by the time she lands in Australia. Because guess what? She kind of crashes her way through this. I mean, dramatic crashes in Rangoon in the monsoon, flying over shark-infested waters in volcanic, you know, dust clouds. You can't believe she makes it, but she does. So she's really probably our greatest aviator, female aviator. So that flight was about Amy. But of course, I couldn't follow her flight through. You know, we had to sidetrack. We came through Israel. We couldn't come through. She came through Syria, Iraq, Iran, we had to sort of sidetrack all of that and come south through Turkey and Saudi Arabia. But what we managed to do was, with again with Boeing, with the Britney's Great campaign, it was build an international outreach program with it. So everywhere I went, there were just, I was at schools, conferences, colleges, speaking wherever I went. But the highlight really was visiting the schools and speaking to these girls, often just you know, from the age of 5 up to 17. And these are girls in Saudi Arabia, in India, in Pakistan, who came out to meet me at airports. And it was just, honestly, the flying is one thing. But, you know, I don't have my own family, and I think perhaps that's the price you pay. But it was really something for me to meet these young girls who were just, you know, you don't think that they would even relate to something like this. But it was like, no, we want to be pilots. You know, a bunch of 10-year-olds in Pakistan, we all want to be pilots. So I just think if girls were given that opportunity in some of the most difficult cultures, you know, who traditionally suppress women, you know, and that's throughout, you know, the Middle East or many places in the Middle East, it's improving. But of course, even in Western democracies, you know, there are still only 5% of women who are commercial pilots. So we can adopt a sort of patronizing attitude towards some of these countries who subjugate women. But actually, we haven't fared that much better, you know, in the West, frankly.
I mean, yeah. You know, you point out in one part of the book, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you were talking about Pakistan, and you were talking about the percentage of female commercial pilots, which was like double the United
India.
States.
Oh, it's India. It's India. Well, there you go. And here's the contradiction. Here's the paradox. In a country where women's human rights, I mean, some of the things that go on with women in India, they believe they're treated worse than animals. But horrific, horrific civil rights, human rights and abuses that go on. And yet that country is an outstanding example of how they promoted females in aviation. And as you said, in something like, you know, it's like 12% of their commercial pilots are women. It just, a statistic that blows me out the water. I just, you know, it's a fantastic reflection on what they're doing in aviation, of which I might add Boeing is a big part of. So we made India the centerpiece of the expedition for historical reasons as well. I mean, I don't want to say British Empire, but it was. That was what drove aviation in Britain, was to get out to all the reaches of empire, whether that was South Africa, or India, or Australia, etc. In America, what drove aviation was getting the mail and the checks across America. That was the transcontinental, and that was more important than passengers. The mail, airmail, came before commercial air travel for passengers, which was, again, yeah, fascinating to me. So yes, to retrack this route all the way through what was the British Empire, because that's, you know, it was funny, Amy Johnson herself said, she said, wherever I was flying this route, you know, in the most remote places, I only had to land, and in about 10 minutes, an Englishman in a pith helmet would appear. And that was the British Empire. We were everywhere. I mean, it's horrifying, isn't it? But in that respect, it was probably easier to do it in the 1930s, weirdly, than it is now, because the bureaucracy and the controls and the procedures and the security issues and the politics that you're now dealing with make it extremely difficult and extremely expensive to do. So back in the day, you could just take your maps, you know, and fire off with, you know, a bit of oil on board and take, you know, take your chances. You wouldn't do that now, I can tell you.
No, in matter of fact, it is interesting that so many of these very small countries, or at least countries that do not have a lot of aviation, and the bureaucracies of getting, you go into the detail about this, but there was one section that kind of made me laugh out loud, where one of the I believe one of the controllers that was admonishing you at the time about, you know, saying, you know, I don't know about how you people in England want to do this, but we care about safety. Like,
oh, I tell you what, that was actually in Africa. That was Victoria Falls, you know, one of the seven wonders of the world. And I thought, oh, do you know what? I had been talking to a pilot in South Africa before we took off, because usually the traffic the air traffic is stacked over the falls up to 10,000 feet. You know, you've got all the tourist operators, the helicopters, and it's a scrum just flying the falls. And I said, oh, do you know, I really, this is one of the highlights of the trip, and I'm so keen to see it with a clear view. And the guy said, he said, oh no, he said, just time it. Look, it's off season. Time it for lunchtime. Fill your boots. There'll be nobody there. So we came barreling down the Zambezi River. And because it's canyon country, it's like the Grand Canyon, it's sunk. You don't see it. All you see is this puff of smoke, which is actually water vapor. So it's very exciting on the approach to the falls, and then suddenly it's just there. And of course, as the chap had said, there was nobody in sight. There was a few buzzards circling overhead. So we flew it at about 150 feet. You were just about flying through the water vapor, and just circled. I mean, totally not illegal, but you know, we were pushing our luck here. But it was just so circled several times and had a good look. And of course, you come into land at Livingston, which is the airfield, and it's about 3 or 4 miles from the falls. So I radioed in, and they said, well, you should be at 4,000 feet. I was at 2,000 feet. The elevation is probably 1,800, 1,500 feet above sea level. So I was maybe 800 feet above the ground, and they were telling me that I needed to be higher for the approach. And I just said, you know, I mean, it's extremely hot at this point, I might add, and it's midday. And I said, look, I've got visual contact with the runway, requested a straight in approach. And they sort of slightly argued it, but I insisted, and I came in and landed. And it was great because there were baboons running along the side of the runway with me. And it was just, you know, berserk. It was wonderful. But the last thing you want to hear as a pilot is the call from the tower saying, call the tower. So you know you've done something wrong. So I was summoned to the tower, and the head air traffic controller, a big black guy, and he was, you know, he took a very dim view of the whole thing. He just said, you know, now, you know, what exactly, you know, you were lower than you should have been. You know, clearly you're not conversant with our procedures here. And I kind of said, look, you know, obviously we're tourists, you know, and I said, I'm recreating this flight. I tried to kind of fluff my way through this, but he wasn't having a bar of it. He said, you know, this sort of thing might be all very well in Britain, but here in Zambia, we have health and safety. Okay, Roger that. So I thought is apologize profusely for, you know, not following the procedures. And you know, and that was that. You know, there was no real problem. I just, you know, went and had a large gin and tonic after that. One of the great flights in Africa, I must say. So it was worth the reprimand.
Well, one of the themes that sort of goes through that is, you know, general aviation, doing it with this flying with a biplane, flying with a steerman, but or any type of general aviation is so not the standard in so many parts of the world that everything is designed for commercial aviation. And so there is that theme of altitude, of, you know, everyone wanting you to be at commercial aircraft altitudes. And the steerman as many, many things, but I think not, you know, a high altitude aircraft is not one of them. So tell me a little bit about how that factored into all of your journeys.
Well, you know, mostly we could fly this. I could fly it low. You know, I was flying low because I had cameras all over the airplane. We had a Cessna Caravan that was with us on the Africa flight. We had a Pilatus, a PC-6 on the Australia flight, really to carry the equipment. Often we had to carry fuel and oil and all the spares and tooling for the steerman. So there's a lot of kit you're carrying there because there's nothing there. You have to be totally self-sufficient. In places you can have fuel brought in at great cost, but you've got to have all of this set up along your route. So generally, I was flying really very low. And when I say low, you know, 200 feet in the Sahara, 200 feet up the Nile. Fantastic. Now, I agree, if the engine goes, you know what? You've got a problem on your hands. But it was so exhilarating and so beautiful that you're just absolutely in the moment, and you think, well, you know what? Everything's a risk, isn't it, in life? And you make your choices, don't you? But it was but re the upper end of the altitude, I mean, here we go. The worst places, I have to say, Egypt was an absolute nightmare to fly in. They treat you like a commercial airliner. Although they were advertising on the ground, they were saying, we've got the oldest airplane in the world flying up Egypt. But once you're in the air with the military, with the air traffic controllers that are controlled by the Egyptian military, and they're absolutely paranoid because if there's some sort of breach of airspace, there's obviously huge repercussions with the military. So they wanted us up at, you know, 8,000 feet, 10,000 feet. And of course, you're up in huge winds. They want you climbing to this altitude above your departing airfield. You'd be running out of fuel. You know, at one point, one of the flights into Cairo, 5.5 hours, right on the edge of our fuel capacity, up at 8,000 feet. Stupidly, I didn't have my flying jacket with us. We'd got distracted with all this media. I hadn't put my flying jacket on, so I'm flying in a t-shirt and just my flying suit, and you're up near the freezing level for 5.5 hours. By the time I fell out of that airplane, I was just, you know, awful. And arguing with the controller, saying, can we descend? Can we descend? You know, there's too much wind up here. And then they'd be screaming at me to go faster, because obviously they were reading ground speed, which was then falling back to 50 miles an hour. I said, well, let me descend. You go back. You know, they would send you back. And this was, it just became horrific. I'd never actually fly in Egypt again off the back of that experience. It was awful in that era. So, yeah.
Out of the sort of non-Western countries, so if we take you know, Australia and Europe off the thing, and not currently talking about your America flight, which countries were the easiest?
What, removing Africa?
So you have to remove all of Africa for that?
Parts of Africa were just heaven, because you can do what you like. You can fly it as you like. You know, once you're out of the control zones, you know, and you're not, there's nothing, there's no, you know, there's no towns or anything. You're just out in the wilderness. You're in the Rift Valley. It's just vast open space. You know, the Sahara Desert, there's nothing there. You know, and just again, whistling along there, even 50 feet above the sand, in this blaze of light with the wings almost on fire from the sun. Things like that. It was surreal, Jeff. Absolutely surreal. It was so beautiful. You'd get out and sometimes I'd have to lie down because I'd be in this almost trance-like state. It was just the most extraordinary thing I've ever done. Very few people to get to fly like that in that sort of terrain, you know, without all this clutter of radio and airspace and procedures and all that stuff that complicates and degrades the experience for me. I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to fly it. Fly it, experience three-dimensional movement. And when you can do that, you almost are in another dimension. And I'm talking a spiritual dimension. It became, for me, it sounds kind of over-egg, doesn't it? But it becomes almost transcendental.
Wow. That's really amazing.
As I was flying it, I just knew Africa. I thought, this is the best thing I'll ever do in my life. I'm on the roof of my life, and this is it. This is the moment.
That's wonderful. I also loved the part of the story where you came across into Australia, but into more Aboriginal Australia, and how people knew and were there to support you.
I have to say the Australians were sensational, because we had a big issue in Indonesia, and I won't sidetrack on that. You'll have to read the book for that one, but that the whole expedition nearly ground to a halt with that one. So we lost our chase plane, the support aircraft. So Ewald Gritsch and I pushed on in the Stearman from Indonesia, crossed the Timor Sea, absolutely epic crossing to Australia. The Australian immigration let us fly in to a place called Truscott, which was not an official entry point for customs and so on. So they let us fly in. And then we had to fly up the coast to Darwin. So we're in a very remote part of Australia, which is all Aboriginal. We'd lost everything. You know, we had a big camera so we could go on doing some of the filming, but we'd lost, you know, we were putting motor fuel in the Stearman to cross the Timor Sea. So that's what happened. So we'd had a serious, serious problem in Indonesia. Anyway, so we get to Australia and the Australians are falling over backwards to help us. And of course, they're so laid back, you think you're in the 1930s, because it's like you'd be flying in buzzing dirt strips. And we landed at one remote place. It was called Kilkeringi. And I'd done an interview in Darwin. So as we landed on this dirt strip and sort of looking around, and you know, the flies are just closing and they're crawling under your glasses, and it's 50 degrees Celsius. This is 120 degrees Fahrenheit. It was blisteringly hot. So you land at this place, nowhere in sight, and suddenly, you know, a couple of the locals pull up in a flatbed truck and get out and, you know, Saw you on the news this morning, love. Thought you might be needing a bit of fuel. They had some jerry cans on the back of it, so we put enough in it to get to the next place. And I just said, oh, I'm loving this. And it was like being in the 1930s, because that's what they used to do. They'd go buzz, you know, barnstorming. People would come out to meet them and bring fuel. And that's really how we got across Australia. They were sensational. In fact, one place in Oodnadatta, it's called. Again, it was an old Aboriginal trail. And this is now in the kind of, it's getting down towards, not Sydney, but somewhere in the desert. All of Australia is a desert, by the way. I can report that 3,000 miles of desert, I didn't see. I saw about three, I never saw, we saw kangaroos. There's something like 50,000 camels out there, never saw one of them. And a few emus strolling around in the middle of nowhere. But we landed at this place in Oodnadatta, and famously it has this pink roadhouse. Okay, so it's a joke. Pink roadhouse, baby pink. It's got pink kayaks out the front. The guy arrives at the airfield in a pink Stetson, and he's brought us some fuel. But he insisted that we drive into town to have a cold drink at his roadhouse. And he actually said, you know, love, you should have just landed on the main street, pulled her up to the pump, we'd have filled you up here, love. I thought, fantastic. So Australia was terrific. Absolutely. And that more than made up for the Indonesians, but they very mixed fortunes, very different from one country to the next.
Yeah. So tell me about your flight following the United States mail route.
Well, we shipped it. I don't have the range to cross oceans. So we shipped it from Sydney to Seattle. So I had a big welcome there with Boeing in Seattle, and I'd go and visit all the factories, see all the, you know, the Dreamliner production line and the 747. So I had a wonderful time in Seattle. So we put the airplane back together there. So I was back and forth between England, and then set off to fly, you know, Seattle down that west coast to Los Angeles, and then from Los Angeles right across the country to Long Island, ending up at Republic Airfield in Long Island. And Boeing, of course, had some of the early airmail contracts. I think the San Francisco Chicago run, although it wasn't themed around, you know, the female stuff. I mean, everybody knows about Amelia Earhart in this country. She was the first woman to fly across America. She never flew for the mail. The only female who did do a brief stint with the US airmail, and the America had one of the first airmail services in the world. But Catherine Stinson did a little bit of that, but was washed out fairly early, and again was fighting extraordinary misogyny and bullying and so forth. But she was another wonderful pilot, but she wasn't kind of part of the scope of what I was doing. But so I was intrigued by the airmail pilots. I mean, the fatality rate was horrific. They called it the suicide club. You know, I think in the first 40 airmail pilots, nearly 30 of them died. It was unbelievable, the courage of these young men. Again, the pioneers and that sense of a new era. And there it is across country. But, you know, so here you go. Having flown nearly 30,000 miles in the Stearman up to this point, I'm flying across America and I have an engine failure in Winslow, Arizona. So we had stopped there. We'd had an epic day of flying through the Grand Canyon, through Lake Powell and Monument Valley. And we'd stopped to refuel in Winslow. And I was absolutely enthralled to find an original airmail hangar. I never knew it was there. So Charles Lindbergh had been there in the 20s and surveyed the airfield. And that became part of, you know, the airmail route officially in the 1920s. So we'd stopped, we were filming in the hangar. There's nothing else there, I might add. And set off just after 5 that evening, and you know, beautiful evening. We were flying down to Phoenix for the night, so just 100 miles to the south. There was this wonderful crater out near, I'm sure, you know, most Americans will know about it, pilots. There's a fantastic crater there that was hit by a meteorite, and it's just 30 miles or something from Winslow. So we were going to take the crater in the sunset and then go on down to Phoenix. But just a few 30 seconds after takeoff, I had a partial engine failure. So it lost about 300 RPM of power. And of course, Winslow is high. You know, it was a density altitude of about 7,000 feet. Winslow is, I think, 5,000 feet above sea level. So, you know, in operating in those environments, what we call, well, you understand, high density altitudes, you know, you have degraded engine performance, and then losing that additional 300 RPM was enough to stop the aeroplane flying. So I only got to about 80 feet. And of course, it's open desert, but there were some power lines in front. So I just turned it. You know, in my mind, I'd gone through this scene over and over. If I have a problem, so long as you can get that aeroplane within 30 degrees of the ground, you'll survive it. You know, it's strong as anything. And that's effectively what happened. Just deflected it through about 30 degrees to the left and flew it into the ground. And although it's desert, it's still rugged. You know, it's covered in sage bushes. And as I hit with quite a bit of energy, it tore the right hand undercarriage leg off and put us into a kind of diagonal cartwheel. So, and it ended right way up. The boys were overhead filming in a Cessna, so caught some of this. And one of the cameras was running because we'd been filming all day in the Grand Canyon. So all the batteries had run out, but one camera was still going. So we caught a little bit of the crash. So basically I destroyed the airplane. But the wings, you know, the huge structure of the wings, the wood and fabric, as that somersault, it absorbed the energy of the crash and it kind of rotated around the cockpit. So, you know, I had Ewald Gritsch with me in the front. We just stepped out. I mean, it was this terrible kind of, you know, it was almost normal stepping out of it. But, you know, neither of us were injured, but the whole thing was just a kind of, you know, the sand was still settling and dripping and creaking and the boys circling overhead. And I just sort of, you know, gave them the thumbs up to say, we're absolutely fine. And, you know, of course, the first call is to the insurance broker. You're never going to believe this. And, you know, I'm on the phone to London, you know, and this was like five, must have been 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And suddenly a woman was shouting to me, you know, she'd obviously seen this from a road, you know, 200 or 300 yards away. And she was saying, oh, my God, is everybody all right? And I'm on the phone to London. I sort of turned around. I said, you know, no, we're absolutely fine. No, fine. Thank you very much. She was quite hysterical, but I thought, you know, and I thought, gosh, how British. There I'm on the phone. The airplane's rolled up in a ball behind me. And here's this poor woman trying to, you know, offer help here. And I've just sort of brushed her off. You know, we're British. We'll clear up the mess. Don't worry, love. But yeah, I'd wrecked the airplane. It was just an absolute bloody catastrophe, frankly. And they couldn't find us initially. I mean, you know, we were about a mile and a half from the airport. So it took about 40 minutes before the rescue services came out. And then they got a crane on site. And we had this spectacular, you know, rescue from the desert as they lifted the wreckage on the crane and all filmed against this blood red sunset. And they took it back. Guess what? To the old airmail hangar, and so there it was. We'd been filming just a couple of hours before, and then it was taken. It was taken to Phoenix. The FAA were absolutely brilliant. They just cleared. The carburetor had blocked on it, so it was some sort of contamination in the carburetor that had just caused the loss of power. They cleaned that out and they got the engine running. Put clean fuel in it and got it running. But, you know, there we were, stopped in our tracks. So I had the wreck airlifted back to Europe, back to Rare Bird Aviation in Austria, Hungary. Had it put, you know, it was basically a new aeroplane. And 3 months later, we had it back in the air. So I was able to attend Boeing Centenary at the Farnborough Air Show in England. And the following spring, I shipped it back to Santa Monica, back to Los Angeles, and we reflew America. So, wow. You know, and that's why it became the Spirit of Victory. It was like, you know, it had a whole new name, a whole new kind of, and that was it. So we've got the film. So, you know, that's the book, it's the film, and I hope that will also be released soon.
Wow. I'm just amazed at the 3 months. I mean, you could take 3 months just trying to do a repair on a modern aircraft here right now, or trying to get an engine done. That's impressive.
It was, you know, it was a fantastic team, and Ewald Gritsch, it was one of the great, none of this could have happened without him. You know, he was a steerman specialist, an engineer and a pilot, and meeting him, he was a huge part of all the expeditions and his team of engineers in Hungary. You know, so they had a new set of wings there. They had already had an engine on the test bed, you know, so the fuselage was then became a conglomerate of etc. So they did a wonderful job on it and just worked around the clock. I mean, literally around the clock, making that happen because they just knew how important it was. So, you know, so it's been a story. And at the heart of all of this story is this love affair with this aeroplane, this steerman, you know, and I'm just besotted with the aeroplane.
It's absolutely wonderful. Well, the book again is Bird. Really, absolutely fantastic. Three extraordinary flights, one woman's remarkable journey. And if we could let people know, I mean, your website is birdinabiplane.com. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
And if people want to reach out to you in order to get that, if you'd like to give us your contact information for that.
Yeah, well, it's on Amazon, and it's I gather the audiobook is also sort of is available on Amazon, but I brought the stock with me to America. So working on my outreach here with the Cy Robin Foundation. So I brought the book with me to support my public engagements here. But so, yeah, contact me by email, which is Tracy, T-R-A-C-E-Y, at birdinabiplane.com.
Excellent.
So, yeah.
Well, Tracy, we've reached the time of the show that we'd like to do something we call Social Flights Fast Five, if you are up for that.
Sounds terrifying, Jeff, but yeah.
You've done an awful lot of things. If this is the most terrifying thing you do, I think you are going to be absolutely fine. All right. Tracy Curtis Taylor, this is your Social Flights Fast Five. Five questions to get to know you a little bit more for folks out there. And of course, also for people to be able to learn more about your book, Bird, which is Three Extraordinary Flights, One Woman's Remarkable Journey. I'd like to start with question number one, which is your epic flights have taken you through so many countries and cultures. Aside from kind of the Western ones that seem kind of so familiar, what country was probably, I guess, the most unique or surprising in a really positive way that you take a really special memory from?
Oh, God, can I have two, Jeff?
Absolutely. I'm going to give you two.
Okay.
Two. Wait, let me rephrase. What two countries are there?
Kenya for the flying, because that was my out of Africa moment, and to fly that terrain, that epic, almost biblical terrain with those animals, you know, the elephants, and that was one of the most profound experiences of my life. So that one's very clear cut. As far as the people, children, girls engagement, Pakistan. And that was going to a school with 2,000 schoolgirls who were all dressed as pilots with biplanes stuck to their heads. They had Blériot moustaches, all singing and chanting, cards, we all want to be pilots, you know, they'd written poetry for me. I was completely overwhelmed by it. And that's a great feature of the film. So that was a huge surprise because Pakistan was fraught with political and security issues, but they were magnificent hosting us there, the Pakistan Air Force, and meeting these girls at the Darwood Foundation School. Absolute highlight of my life.
Absolutely wonderful. All right. Question number two, during all of this flying that you have done, both on the journeys and as well as during your training, is there a particularly either scary or impactful moment from this flying that you believe you took something away with, that you've learned something from for your life?
You know, you can be so frightened on the ground, and it can be terrifying in the air sometimes. The weather, I think, is always the most terrifying thing, the weather. So whatever you think, I've had weather close in. I mean, literally flying on the deck at tree level in heavy rain, in cloud. You know, some of that was terrifying. And you just, you know, insane when I look back on it. But never underestimate the weather. And as a VFR pilot, I've never done instrument flying, very basic instrument flying. I don't do that. But it was a salutary reminder how overwhelming the weather is. And even though there's all this wonderful forecasting now, you know, but never, ever underestimate that, because the elements are always overwhelming.
Yeah. That's an excellent lesson. That makes sense and certainly applies to absolutely everyone. All right. Question number three, if you could choose some specific moment in time to go back and relive, not to change it, to bask in it, and something really beautiful about your flying or time, where would you put yourself?
Oh, I'd be back. I'd be back in the late 1920s. I really would. I think that golden age of aviation, you know, the whole Charles Lindbergh thing, the start of that, the pioneers. I think there was just such excitement and such hope for aviation. So, you know, aviation as a military force hadn't really been mobilized. You know, early indicators of that in World War One, but it was still quite limited. So by the time, the military and the wars have always driven development, the technology in aviation, and that's maybe an unfortunate thing because I think that's also what's blocked women from aviation for so long. It was such a military controlled activity, really. And it's those structures that have kept women out for so much of the 20th century. But yeah, I would go back to that era, definitely, the 1920s and 30s, for cars and airplanes. That's my era.
Wonderful. All right, question number four. If you could go back in time and give some advice to your younger self in your teens or 20s, what do you think you would say?
I would say, you always put yourself under so much pressure, and that there's always so much urgency. And I think when I see the world today, just the pressure to communicate, for example, I think I just say, do you know what? There's more time than you realize. I wish I'd pace myself a bit more. I wish I had, I was thinking if I'd flown before I went to Africa, or if I'd gone to university or so on. They're not regrets particularly, but I was in a rush. I was quite a restless person, and I wanted results. I liked action, and I still do. But I'm a lot older and wiser now, so I tend to roll with it a bit more and let things play out.
Excellent. That makes a lot of sense. All right. And our last question, question number five. If you could choose anyone from history or current, for past, present, with us, or no longer with us, to spend an evening with, who do you think you might choose?
Oh, I'm going to bore everybody with this answer. William Shakespeare. I would conjure
There's
up
nothing
William
boring about
Shakespeare.
that.
Oh, does it have to be an aviator?
It does not. Absolutely not. And there's nothing boring about choosing William Shakespeare, especially since it makes you fairly unique with that answer. That is wonderful.
No, actually, to make it a bit more contemporary, because that's a bit obscure, I would probably choose Denis Finch-Hatton, because I know so much about Karen Blixen. But he died in a flying accident, and he also found aviation. He was adored Africa, and he was there in that era. I think that's the person I'd have dinner with,
Tell us a
Denis
little bit more about
Finch-Hatton.
him.
Oh, he was an English aristocrat, who was, he was an extraordinary, a very princely sort of person, very, very, very well educated. But he also became one of the great white hunters, which is not, particularly exemplary in itself, but that was very much part of the era. But he went to Africa, I think, to escape the confines of society there. I mean, younger sons did get blown out to the colonies like milkweed, didn't they? So he ends up in Africa, fights there, as part of World War One. They were fighting for England out there. But he just cut such an unusual character in a way. I mean, very English. He's a very English character. But I think because I know so much about Karen Blixen's life and her part of their love story, but he encapsulates the male side of that, his passion for flying and adventure. He was great friends with Teddy Roosevelt, who was with Kermit Roosevelt, who was President Roosevelt's son, Teddy Roosevelt's son. So he was a very international character. He was there taking royal parties around, hunting, shooting parties in Africa. Very, very well connected, but an extraordinary individual. And he was killed at 43 in a flying accident in Africa. And that was the end of their love affair. And shortly after, she lost her African farm. And that whole story just resonates deeply with me, and has been, in a funny sort of way, it's been a huge influence in my life,
Wow.
for better or for worse. The romantics, the restless romantics.
Well, restless romantics and longing for aviation is certainly a theme that goes through everything. So again, the book is Bird by Tracy Curtis Taylor. Thank you so much for joining us this evening, Tracy. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you in person at Oshkosh, where your aircraft is going to be front and center in Boeing Plaza.
That's exactly right. Well, Jeff, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. And we'll meet again very soon. Come flying.
Absolutely. I look forward to that. Take care.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you to all of you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday evening. That's July 10th, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That will be our Cockpit to Cowl show with Brian Schiff and myself. We're going to be talking about taming temperatures. Cockpit to Cowl, of course, is our show where Brian represents the aircraft instructor and professional pilot and that perspective, and I'll bring the mechanic side of it to the discussion, and we'll be talking all about temperatures and what you can do as things heat up and we grow towards summer. You can register for that show at Cockpit, the number 2, and the word cowl, cockpit2cowl.com. And then we're back here on Social Flight Live on June 17th, that's Tuesday, June 17th, at 8 p.m. Eastern Time with Ken Lux, CEO of Flights to Freedom. This is an incredibly important show. I implore you to take some time and join us here on the show to learn about this. Flights to Freedom is an organization that deals with transporting and rescuing people who are the victims of human trafficking. And there, you will learn in this show that general aviation has an incredibly important role to play on this. Many of these young women, and they're also boys, anyone who's part of this human trafficking, often do not have documentation. They cannot get transportation in so many other ways, and the ability to use general aviation in order to help save these individuals is incredibly important. So again, Tuesday, June 17th, 8 p.m., that is Ken Lux, of CEO of Flights to Freedom. Until next time, I'm Jeff Simon for Social Flight. Thank you so much for joining us here for our show, and I wish you all blue skies.